Station.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my pleasure to have as my guest Alice Sebold, whose first novel, The Lovely Bones, was recently published by Little Brown. It's received extraordinary attention, even in advance of publication. She's the author, as well, of a memoir called Lucky, which I gather will be being reprinted by Little Brown in paperback. And these two books bear more in common than many autobiographical memoirs and first novels. And it does seem like the second book is born out of the experiences of that led to the writing of the first and out of the writing of the first.
Well, actually, the truth is that I started Lovely Bones before I wrote Lucky. I paused in the composition of Lovely Bones to go back and write Lucky in about 18 months, and then I returned to the novel. But definitely the memoir describes what has to obviously be the seed of a preoccupation I have, which is rape and sexual assault and violence in general.
Now, in Lovely Bones, what interested and surprised me is that given the terror and grittiness of the first chapter, the book really does move toward a kind of heavenly reconciliation. Do you believe that such a reconciliation is possible? Because I'm thinking that a lot of books would have been, if it were written in the 70s, mm-hmm. a very bleak book.
Right. I would say I hope that such a reconciliation is possible. I like to live on my best days with the idea that it is. I think for me, having had a pretty bleak experience, one of the ways that you go on living is to believe that there are other things out there that you can't fully ever understand, no matter how much you, say, analyze them or read about them or study them, that the intellect is actually not the key to freedom, that there's something else as well.
What might that thing be?
That's out there? I don't know. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's again, to be comfortable with the idea of not being able to define it exactly, but walking around believing that it's somehow present.
Now, the book takes a really audacious risk, which is that it's narrated by a murdered and raped 14-year-old girl who is viewing her family from heaven. And because heaven is the place that the book ultimately takes place. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know if you believe in it.
I believe in an idea of an early draft of this. A friend of mine said, "Oh, I hate heaven. Why don't you just call it that other place?" And I understood what she meant by that. So I believe in an idea of another place. In this book, I call it heaven. I think, you know, heaven is one of those words that has so many preconceived ideas attached to it that I believe in something, and it is probably a version of a heaven.
It seems to be, among other things, a place where the heroines of one's favorite books go. Mm-hmm. One of the women up there has renamed herself Holly after Holly. What is her name?
Go lightly.
And the other one was Franny. And in my private fantasy, she had emerged differently spelled from Salinger. Mm. But the book seemed to be a cousin of books like that. Books that seem to want to be the reader to be's favorite novel. Did you have an image of being beloved?
I have to say that's probably the farthest away from any image I've ever had of myself. Actually, I almost daily calculate who's hating me and why. So, yes, no, not at all.
Because, of course, the book is being compared to Kill a Mockingbird and books that seem to me to welcome the reader in and brush off the chair and offer him cookies. There's so much generosity in this book after its first two or three chapters that it seems almost as if its writer is trying to say, I know that watching this child be raped and killed has taken a lot out of you. Would you care for a soft drink?
Well, my desire is definitely to have the most hellish thing presented, because that is the truth and a truth that happens all the time, but to also offer the solace to the reader of the idea that there is something else. There is hope out there, and that hope is found among the people that surround you. And in this novel, in that case, the characters that you come to know through Susie. So.
Now, in some cases, the idea of narrating from heaven would just be a tenet of magical realism, something that's happened in recent years. In others, it would be an item of faith and some kind of dogma. Which is it for you?
Again, none of those ideas or words or concepts entered my head when I was writing the book. So after the fact, I would say that it presents itself in those clothes, but in my own creating of it, it was just a nude animal I was really fascinated with, and I never thought that it was one specific school or approach. And my hope would be that it doesn't fall into anything specific, that it can just be borne aloft by itself.
No, because what I want to talk about is not so much the categories as, you see, I think that literary people will be able to accept the heaven, people who read novels,
right,
very easily. But I think a religious person might be very challenged by what might be seen as a cavalier use of faith and hope. And I wondered if you worried about that.
No, I never worried about it. I think there are a lot of people that exist on the borderline between the people you're talking about and then the people who would feel I was being cavalier. And I probably exist on that borderline somewhere. People who will just judge something based on its individual merits. And if they feel an invitation to come in, there are plenty of people who, if it's told from heaven, want nothing to do with it. And I can't control that. So they'll stay outside, but it's a nice party, and it's too bad they're missing it.
Oh no, but I think it's become, the frequency with which angels and heavenly messengers, and especially in the movies, the number of things, even before It's a Wonderful Life, that invite one to see life on Earth as existing in the eye of a friendly spirit. I mean, this is hardly... this is a factor of popular American art, even popular kitsch. And I thought that perhaps the thing that you were dealing with is to rescue this material from kitsch.
Well, I did avoid things like the mention of angels and anything that I felt had been too co-opted already. It was a decision to keep the word heaven in the book, even though that's the way I had initially drafted it. I then had a choice to not do that, but I decided to keep it there. And part of the reason why is because I do believe that unless we go ahead and reclaim those things from the kind of kitsch world, the only place they will exist is in the kitsch world, and you really lose something when that happens.
Because it's been my real interest There was once a time when serious writers had to be dark. Hmm. As I was saying, there was a period in the 70s where a happy ending, forget it.
Right.
Even a moderately, a tempered happy ending. Now I'm wondering whether the most seditious thing to do might not be to give people the happiness they seem to insist on and want, but make them think about other things as well. And I began to think, would it be possible, since people really do, they love kitsch. I mean, it may be bad taste to me, but it's beloved.
Right.
I mean, it is the culture we live in.
Right.
Could one make a novel entirely out of kitsch?
Probably it wouldn't. It's out there to be done. So yes, I mean, one of the things that I've experienced with this book is that if I had set limitations on it, it never would have existed. So the idea that a novel couldn't be created completely out of kitsch is wrong as well. I think probably yes.
It's sort of interesting because this was so much on the verge that I became, but I thought intentionally so.
Well, in terms of depicting the 70s and some of those things like huckaboo shirts and, you know, makeup products or elephant bell-bottom pants that the 14-year-old girl is wearing, yes, because those are the things that surround her world. One of the fascinations with that era for me is that it was the beginning of it. We were innocent in the production of those things. And we didn't realize that I think we were creating this polyester world of kitsch. And now we're on the other side of the commentary on the polyester kitsch. We've come full circle somehow, I think.
Yeah, but I'm thinking also the way things can become kitsch, like serial killer kitsch.
Right.
I think that, you know, when I read that this man, George Harvey, makes dollhouses and lives alone, I said, oh, make me shiver. Because I recognized him immediately from what's become the culture kitsch of serial killer.
Right, right.
And that's what I mean, that there's so much in this book that plays on both sides and seems to need to as well, that there's an idea about American culture, American families, American violence that needs to be advanced. And it's almost as if in order to advance it, you've given it a sugar coating. You get to say a lot of what you want to say, a lot of what's said much more directly in Lucky, through the vehicle, it seems to me, of heaven and a certain kind of stock villain, that kind of thing.
I guess I would say that I never thought of, I mean, serial killers do exist, and we've made them into kitsch, but they exist. And for me, I mean, I never thought, for instance, of George Harvey, the killer in this book, as a serial killer. I just thought of him as a killer. It ends up that he's killed others, so then we put the word serial killer on him. I mean, the men who do kill in this way, they're just killing. They're not thinking, wow, I'm a serial killer, I'm a rock star. I mean, we're the people that that have the internet clubs based on and the trading cards based on serial killers. And if anything, I think my effort in this book was to bring it back down to what was real, which is the loss of a child to this specific family, so that we become a little bit less immune to the real impact of violence.
You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm talking to Alice Siebold, the author most recently of The Lovely Bones, published by Little Brown. Now, at the end of Lucky, you are a poetry student. You are kicking a heroin habit. Things are pretty down. The book says that you said to your sister, you may have been a Phi Beta Kappa majoring in languages. I majored in rape. And there is that moment when you said the most important thing I did in my life was to see the rapist imprisoned. Mm-hmm. What gave you the confidence? Did that book give you the confidence to go on to this kind of book? This book is very full of confident self-declamation.
I think having stopped The Lovely Bones and going back to Lucky and getting my story out and away allowed Susie and the characters in the book to take over the world and make that world their own and have me just, you know, other than writing it, have very little to do with it. I would say also that I have a particular drive that has been with me my whole life. I experience the world as extremely alienating, and I'm constantly trying to make connection or bridge to other people. And both of these books, as both memoir and fiction, there's something about that for the characters in the novel, and certainly for me in the depiction of myself in Lucky. You know, by trying to say here I am and I'm very alienated. Here are these characters and they're very alienated. What I'm in some sense trying to say is, aren't we all really alienated? you know, you show me yours and I'll show you mine, kind of thing. So.
Now, Tess Gallagher looms very large as a presence in Lucky, both as a teacher and as someone who came with you to the first questionings. What are they called?
Pre-trial hearing.
Yes. And what moved you then from poetry to prose?
I went to the University of Houston for an MFA in poetry right out of college. And I was taking some great classes in poetry, but I was dating somebody who was taking classes in prose. And it was just one of those simple juvenile things of, you know, I can do that. And I sat down and I started writing, and I wrote about 90 pages very quickly. And I love the feeling of it. I love the drive of it. And I love the ability to really explore and to go wherever you wanted to that prose gave me. So my hope was to be able to take my love of language, which led me to the poetry, and bring it into the prose.
And then you moved to Irvine, where you started to work on these two books?
I moved actually from Houston to New York City, where I was lived for about 10 years. But then, yes, I'm fond of saying, as my husband will mimic me, I moved to California at 33 with 13 boxes and kind of started my life over by going to graduate school at Irvine, yes.
Well, you studied with some truly remarkable people,
yes.
Ray Carver, Tess Gallagher, Tobias Wolff, Jeffrey Wolff, you know, can you say what a teacher gives a writer with a couple of specific instances?
Sure. I mean, one of the things I would say, particularly about my teachers that I had as an undergraduate, the poet Hayden Carruth would be added to Tess, Ray, and Toby, is that during my 10 years in New York, which were very difficult for me, and I was pretty self-destructive in a lot of my behaviors, they existed as kind of moral imperatives somehow. And I could always think of them and think, for instance, of how Ray Carver was very uncomfortable in those big party scenes. And so when I would find myself at a New York party feeling highly uncomfortable, I had this certain kind of feeling like, you know, not to curse, but, you know, kind of, well, forget you guys. Ray Carver would have been, you know, even more nervous than I was. And he's a great writer. So, yeah, you look great in your dress, but whatever. So just even as examples to me, during
that
those 10 years.
Another kind of life is possible.
Right, exactly. And mm-hmm. that you don't have to be great at a party to be a good writer. And this seems so obvious now, but it wasn't to me when I was younger. So in that larger way, and then also in the specific way of being incredibly rigorous about what makes it into a final draft and what doesn't.
Now, I'm very curious to talk about some of the things that I notice in the structure of the book.
Okay.
Am I right in thinking that there was, or even still is, there seems to be a big theme of breaking out of bottles, whether it's the penguin who's caught in the snow dome at the beginning, mm-hmm. eventually the father of the little girl Susie, in his despair and fury, he breaks the ships that he's worked with her. He puts ships in bottles. And there's a sense that, in a way, heaven is at first like that for Susie, that this book is going to be about breaking her out of the perfect world of heaven and re-entering life for a crucial experience. And I wondered, you know, how is that kind of thing, how does that emerge? I'm right.
No, you are right, and I would say that in my experience that it emerges slowly and through happenstance and through writing many other things and stripping those things away and suddenly seeing, oh, bottles. I'm not somebody who figures out a metaphor or an image beforehand. It all happens in the writing. And then the real part for me comes in the revising.
Because I thought, maybe unconsciously, but that the invisible patron saint of that imagery was the bell jar.
That's interesting. It may be. I mean, unconsciously, I read it as a young woman growing up.
And doesn't Ruth read Plath?
Yes, she does. And I will say that I wrote one of my first poems as a young woman was called, may I say with great shame, Bath with Plath.
Oh, my.
So, yes, there's probably something to that.
Because it does seem that, at least in the two books that I've read, that, if you'll pardon me, it might be called Escape from Plath, because it seems as if that kind of hypersensitivity, that strained and very desperate sensitivity, seems to end in suicide, and that these books say, you have to laugh, you have to heal yourself. You can't be catapulting from one desperation to the next. There must be a toughness. It's almost as if, finally, the books say, turn your back on Plath.
I think so. I mean, with all due respect, I did grow up in that era, and I certainly, as a young poet, read a lot of Anne Sexton, a lot of Robert Lowell, and a lot of Plath. And incredibly vibrating work when I read it, tossed back and forth by it in the most wonderful way for an adolescent girl, and then ultimately left with nowhere to go. So I think that's very right. Also, too, as a woman, I think the romantic image of being Plath is something to, if possible, leave behind. You know, there's a movie coming out called The Powerpuff Girls. And I just think to myself, if I were a little girl and seeing The Powerpuff Girls as opposed to reading The Bell Jar, and, you know, that is not to equate The Powerpuff Girls and The Bell Jar at all.
Yes,
but,
yes, it's one or the other.
But, you know, it just gives me this opportunity to feel like I can affect my world. I am not always the reactive being. And in the Plath concept of femininity, you are constantly the reactive being, and that's your merit as opposed to being the active being. The path away from the path away from Plath, my next poem, is definitely where I think I'm headed. Yeah.
I know that you have lived really in a community of writers. And for quite some time, both of your books thank your husband, the novelist Glenn Gould, and Amy Bender. And what is her name? She won a Flannery O'Connor Award.
Catherine Chutkovich.
That's right.
Yeah.
What in particular do writers of a similar age and level of experience learn from one another?
Well, it's interesting. some of us are, there is a good difference in our ages, but that it's about the writing and that it's about the freedom and the exploration. It's not about the product. That also the process of writing can involve others. I think that's really refreshing because you get into this place, and what is very interesting to see is that after you're published, sometimes you feel even more that you can't show your work to anyone until it is really ready to be seen and absolutely bulletproof and absolutely perfect. And if you constantly have workshops with people, as I do, you realize that it's never bulletproof and it's never absolutely perfect, and that the work on the page is a living, breathing animal, and it needs to be, you know, fed and brought out into the backyard like any animal, and told when it's not really acting up to snuff. And I also think you need people to trust that will tell you the truth, and will say, you know, I think this is wonderful, but, or I think you've really taken a wrong turn. And I value that more than anything.
Now, because I realized in The Lovely Bones, one of the final revelations is Susie understands that the bones are not her missing bones, which are sunk in a safe at the bottom of a sinkhole and remain unretrieved, that the bones, the things that hold things together, is the members of the community.
Right.
And I wondered whether that had been reconstituted in your life.
Part of that is a little wishful on my part. I think I did, move to California at 33 to start over again in a world that maybe I could build, and that would be true of. Until that age, I lived very differently, and I was part of the problem, certainly. But now here, I value those connections incredibly deeply, yeah.
I've been talking with Alice Siebold, author most recently of The Lovely Bones, published by Little Brown. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
You can read the first chapter of The Lovely Bones on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse.
Support for Bookworm comes from Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow, today. More information can be found at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at bn.com.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.